That joint committee meeting of the two resource committees will come to order. Present are the two House co-chairs, as well as Senators Taylor, Lincoln, Kelly, Green, and myself, and Representative Dyson, Harris, Jewell. We are here for a presentation on Katie John case. The floor is yours. Can you hear it?
I can hear you pretty well. It's a little far.
Turn the volume of this thing up.
For the record, my name is Joanne Grace. I'm an assistant attorney general for the Department of Law. I understand that the joint committees wanted a report on the present status of the Katie John case. The state this morning filed a notice of appeal in the Katie John case to appeal final judgment of the district court that was entered on January 7th. The state has appealed the Katie John case before, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a decision adverse to the state. The purpose of taking appeal from the final judgment at this point is to try again to convince the United States Supreme Court to review the Ninth Circuit decision, finding that the authority of the Federal Subsistence Board extends to navigable waters in Alaska in which the United States has a Federal Reserve water right. Now, the reason that we have this chance to take this appeal at this point, 5 years after the Ninth Circuit issued its decision, is that the original Ninth Circuit decision was an interlocutory appeal. That means it was an appeal of an order by the district court that was not a final disposition of the case. It's an intermediate appeal of a controlling point of law, but not of a final judgment. Normally, a party in a case must wait until a federal district court is completely finished with the case and has entered final judgment before they have an opportunity to appeal. But in some very rare cases where there is a very important point of law that the district court has decided, a party can petition the district court and then petition the Ninth Circuit to consider the issue immediately. And that's what the state did in this case. In the Katie John case, the federal district court in 1994 ruled that the subsistence priority of that the public lands to which subsistence priority applied extended to all navigable waters in the state of Alaska by virtue of a navigational servitude. At the same time, district court ruled did not depend on a second argument by the plaintiffs in that case that the extent of public lands should be determined by the existence of a reserved water right in navigable waters. So the state at that point asked for an interlocutory appeal to the Ninth Circuit, and the plaintiffs did as well. So the Ninth Circuit decided then in 1995 that public lands consisted of navigable waters in which the United States has a reserved water right. At that point, the state petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to review that decision. One of the major points in opposition that the United States made at that point was that the Supreme Court should not consider this issue on an interlocutory appeal. The Supreme Court should wait until the district court had completely decided the case and issued a final judgment, because considering at that point would be premature. The United States told the Supreme Court that they should wait and see what the federal regulations look like, and they should wait to see if the state amended its constitution before it decides to issue. So the case went back to the district court in 1995. The federal agencies began the process of identifying the waters in Alaska where the right existed. And the district court case was stayed until those regulations became final in October. So now the regulations have become final. The district court has issued a final judgment, and the state has the opportunity now to appeal that. Now, we do have to go through the Ninth Circuit again to try to get the Supreme Court to review the case. We don't expect the Ninth Circuit to really reconsider its decision, but jurisdictionally, we have to do that. We have to appeal now to the Ninth Circuit, and then from that decision, petition the Supreme Court and try to convince them to take the issue. That's the procedural status of the case at this point.
I don't know whether you were going to continue with where we're going, but I guess I'll just ask, try and separate out the questions. This question strictly deals with the water side. So this does not challenge the subsistence federal law on federal lands. Is that correct?
That's correct. The only issue on appeal would be whether the public lands to which the right applies and the corresponding authority of the Federal Subsistence Board to regulate includes navigable waters in which the United States holds the reserve water right. That would be the one issue that the state would be appealing. It's possible that the plaintiffs would cross appeal and argue that public lands, by virtue of navigational servitude, which was an alternative theory, that was the theory that the district court initially accepted, that public lands would include all the navigable waters in Alaska. So that may happen.
Questions by other members of either committee? Senator Taylor?
Yeah. Have the feds withdrawn the regulations that they imposed in January regarding subsistence fishing in marine waters?
I guess I'm not sure exactly which regulations. Final regulations?
Yep.
On subsistence fishing in marine waters. Which, do you know what it is?
For the record, my name is Kathleen Twitter-Shee. I'm also an assistant attorney general with the Department of Law. And the answer to the question is the federal agencies have not withdrawn any of the regulations that were published last January and that became effective on October 1st. Those regulations have specifically exclude federal subsistence jurisdiction in the marine waters of the Tongass and the Chugach National Forest. There are some smaller areas of marine water that appear to fall within their assertions of federal jurisdiction, and those have not been revised.
Okay, but they specify, we've got several definitions here, and it's kind of tough to keep track of them. They did specify that these regulations would not be in force and effect in marine waters of the Tongass and the Chugach.
That's correct.
What about the rest of the marine waters? I mean, those are two withdrawals that they made and might have some implied claim of a reserved water right. There is no withdrawal on the rest of our coast.
Through the chair, that's correct. The regulations apply to all waters, navigable and non-navigable, that fall within the boundaries of identified federal units, and there in the regulation there is a listing of 33 federal units and then a list of about 7 wild and scenic river components, so roughly 40 federal areas. It would also include inland waters that are adjacent to the boundaries of those units, but marine waters would only be included to the extent they fall within the declared boundaries of those units. Significant marine waters would fall particularly in the Chugach boundaries, but those were specifically excluded from the scope of the regulation.
I want to make that clear. Those have been specifically excluded. The only ones that are included are those 40 areas that you talked about that were federal units or wild and scenic rivers?
That's correct.
Okay, how does that comport with the Supreme Court decision in the, I think it's the Volcana case, where we own the submerged lands under those navigable streams?
Through the chair, the recent assertion of authority over waters in which there's a reserved water right is not based on title to the submerged land. The definition of public lands in Title VIII, to which the subsistence priority and the authority of the Federal Subsistence Board applies, is public lands are lands, waters, and interests therein, title to which is in the United States. The Ninth Circuit decision in this case says that the reserved water rights in particular navigable waters within these federal areas is an interest to which the United States has title in those waters, and that thereby renders those waters public lands. It's unrelated to the ownership of the submerged land. The United States isn't claiming any title or authority based on any authority based on title to the submerged land. It's based on an interest that they have in a reserved water right in the water the Ninth Circuit has held, therefore renders them public lands under this particular definition in ANILCA.
Maybe I need to ask the question in a different way. Are there any navigable waters in Alaska today where the federal government has title to those waters? Because the law very specifically says that they have title to which is in the United States.
Through the chair, the United States doesn't claim title to the waters. There are certainly areas where they claim title to the submerged lands. Those are pre-stated withdrawal areas. They claim title to an interest in the water, being a right to in-stream flows.
And this is based on the navigable servitude question or on the implied reservation of waters on a withdrawal? I'm confused there.
Through the chair, the current Ninth Circuit decision is based on the existence of reserved water right, not on the navigational servitude. And the reserved water right is a doctrine that says that when the United States reserves federal lands for a particular purpose, such as a park or wildlife refuge, by implication it also reserves water necessary to fulfill the purposes of the reservation. So, for example, if the United States takes federal land and creates a national park or wildlife refuge, as of the date they're creating it, it is implicitly reserving, if one of the primary purposes of a park or national wildlife refuge was to protect fish habitat, for example, then by implication, it would also be reserving sufficient in-stream flows in the rivers within the park or the wildlife refuge to preserve fish habitat.
Aren't they reserving this in all the post-statehood withdrawals as well as the pre-statehood withdrawals? Are they exerting this based on, you know, the Federal Reserve water rights in that predated statehood or all of them?
Mr. Chair, all of them. It's not an issue that's related to title to the submerged land. Whenever the reservation occurs, the water rights are created. Generally, in the context of reserved water rights, it's significant when the right is created because it determines the rights of the United States to that water vis-a-vis other water claimants. But in the context of Title VIII of ANILCA, it doesn't make any difference when the right occurs because it's just the mere existence of the right that creates, of the water right, that creates the determination that those rivers are public land and that thereby creates the subsistence priority and the authority of the Federal Subsistence Board to take over state management of those fisheries.
Okay. That's the double shuffle of rhetoric by which they say they're not taking back what they gave us at State.
If I could just continue.
Senator Taylor, continue. I just want
to. Thank you for that clarification. I was shocked to hear that they're even making that claim on in areas where the withdrawal occurred after statehood, but I understand the subtle distinction you're trying to make, or you're indicating what their position is. That's not our state's position, is it?
Through the chair, our position is that Congress had no intent in creating that definition of public land to include navigable waters because there's a reserved water right. Congress had no idea that would be.
I'm aware of litigation that occurred in the state of Colorado where attempts were made by the federal government to utilize a reserved water right designation to control in-stream flow and all sorts of other uses of waters down there. And their state had the same choice. They could roll over and surrender everything like we're being told to do around here and let the feds just have this and start controlling our waters, or they could fight them, and that state chose to fight. And because of that, there was, I forget how many streams, several hundred, and they litigated each individual stream to determine what was the purpose of the withdrawal. And they actually went into the purpose that had been stated when the federal government withdrew those lands to find out if water had anything to do with the purpose for the withdrawal. And as a consequence, I think the feds ended up with about 6 rivers out of 600. And the Colorado won the rest of them because it's my understanding from the case law, it can't be just a general reservation. It has to be specific to a purpose. And I thought I heard in your earlier comments something like that. Am I heading down the right path here, Ms. Chase, or am I missing something?
Through the chair, the doctrine states that when the reservation is created, the United States, by implication, reserves sufficient water to fulfill the primary purposes of the reservation.
I think that's an important point. I want to stop you right there. In Colorado, in those cases, the federal government would come in and frequently list 5 or 6 purposes for which they had withdrawn the waters. But under the court decision, they were only allowed to take or maintain their reservation for the primary purpose, not the second or tertiary purpose, only the primary purpose. In the documentation that you've reviewed in preparing for the for both Paratovich and also, of course, for the Glacier Bay suit, is there anything, any place in any of that documentation that would indicate that when they created the Tongass National Forest, as an example, in my district, or the Chugach, that they reserved the water rights and had a specific purpose for which they reserved those water rights?
Through the chair, as far as I know, the doctrine has been applied generally in case law as of the date the reservation was created. And I'm quite sure that when the Tongass was created or when the Chugach was created, the primary purposes of the reservation wouldn't have been furthered by reserving water rights. But it is possible that the United States will argue that they can change the primary purposes of a reservation after it's created, and at that point implicitly reserve water rights, so that even though in 1907 a stated primary purpose of a national forest would not have included reserving water rights, if later the Congress changed the purposes of national forests to include primary purposes that would require water, at that point they would argue the right is created.
I understand they may argue that one, Ms. Chase, but in the Colorado cases, they were not allowed to invent new reasons for having taken or reserved land and thus, by implication, water rights. They were held accountable to what did you reserve it for at the time and what was your primary purpose at the time, not what is your new social engineering purpose that you've come up with 50 years later. Now, why in the world would they be allowed to argue that in the cases that you and I are talking about, when they certainly weren't allowed to argue that in any of the federal cases in Colorado?
Through the chair, I completely agree with you. That's absolutely right, that they were not allowed to, after the fact, create new purposes. What I was referring to was an act of Congress that changed the purposes of national forests, for example, to include as a primary purpose recreational use, which was not a primary purpose of national forests in the turn of the century or whenever.
There's multiple use, though, in 1907.
Right, but my point is that they may have a stronger basis for arguing that further rights were created when Congress changed the purposes outside the context of litigation in subsequent years, after the forest had existed for a number of years. That water right would have only been created at the point Congress changed the law, so the water right would only vest then. But again, for purposes of Title VIII of ANILCA, it's not so much a question of when the water right was created, it's a question of the mere existence of a water right.
Do you honestly believe that there is? I mean, this is going to have huge impacts, not only in Alaska, but on every western state where there are large blocks of federal land and waters flowing through them. If there's this continued navigable servitude or continued reservation of water rights by implication, the impacts on the rest of the lower 48 and all of their navigable streams and waters and the rest of it are huge, because Congress could pass an act at any time saying, well, we take back all the waters that you guys are currently using for irrigation, and we take back all the waters you're using for drinking water purposes in say, Arizona. And now all that water has to be used for the horny toad or something, because we're all concerned about horny toads and whether or not they have enough water out on the range there. I can't imagine was Sandra Day O'Connor completely out of her mind when she wrote the decision in Dinkum Sands, which was only 3 years ago, and said that the state of Alaska not only controlled those submerged lands, but the waters above them and the fish that swim therein? Did she not know what she was talking about?
Oh, through the chair. Well, there's a lot of body in that question. I would say that the question of reserved water rights in Alaska has never been a big issue, because we don't have a lot of competing interests claiming water rights, and it's not a doctrine that really has had any application here until the Katie John case. And so it is our hope that we can convince the Supreme Court to review that Ninth Circuit decision, and that will eliminate the problem that we have about where exactly the right exists. If the definition of public lands is not based on the existence of Federal Reserve water rights, in a real sense, the issue goes away for us.
Yeah. One last question, and I'll quit. You're procedurally now on, you're back into the Ninth Circuit, right? Appeal on Katie John?
Right. We have to go through the Ninth Circuit, because jurisdictionally we can't petition the Supreme Court for a review.
But I thought that the Paratovich case, which deals directly with the reserve water rights claims within the Tongass National Forest, has now been stayed by your filing of the Glacier Bay suit. Why would it not be a waste of judicial time, so to speak, to go through the Ninth Circuit again and do all of that briefing, just so that you can then again petition on the very same subset of issues, if you will, that encompass not directly in Glacier Bay, but very directly in the Paratovich case?
Through the chair. The main issue that the plaintiffs seem to be pushing in the Paratovich case at this point is the question of title to the submerged land. They did raise other claims based on navigational servitude and maybe even on reserve water rights, but they're not pursuing that at this point because of the Katie John decision. So they are not pursuing those claims. They wish to go forward only on the title issue at this point. They haven't conceded those claims because they're not technically bound by the Katie John decision because they weren't a party to it. But they don't seem to be pursuing that. They are at this point pursuing this, want to pursue their title, the claim, I should say, that the United States has title to the submerged land underlying the waters within the Tongass, and that therefore those are all public lands under ANILCA. So I don't think that, I think that the Supreme Court review of the Ninth Circuit decision, the Katie John case, might have some impact on claims in the prejudice case, but those aren't claims that the plaintiffs are really interested in pursuing at this point, as I understand it.
Appreciate your patience and the rest of the committee. Thank you very much. Representative, I think you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joanne, as I understand it, you've indicated that you will be filing today. Is that correct?
Through the chair, we have filed. We filed this morning, and I do have some copies of the notice of appeal if any committee members would like.
Could we have some understanding of what kind of a timeline for those of us who are not familiar with this? If you file today, when will the next substantive action take place?
Through the chair, it's hard to predict this with any accuracy. I can make predictions. I would expect that we would get a briefing schedule from the Ninth Circuit within 6 to 8 weeks. That briefing would take 3 months. And now comes the point in the process that's very hard to predict, and that is how quickly the Ninth Circuit would decide the case. We have some cases that are pending before the Ninth Circuit for years. My expectation would be that this one would go quickly, that the Ninth Circuit would say, we've already seen this issue, we've already seen it in this case. Memorandum decision within several months at the most. So I would say we would expect to be through the Ninth Circuit in less than a year, and at that point, party has 90 days to petition the Supreme Court. The state wouldn't wait 90 days, obviously. And the United States gets about 30 days to respond, and how quickly the Supreme Court would decide whether to take the case depends on whether the cert petition is filed during the Supreme Court session. The Supreme Court session goes from October through June. But the Supreme Court decides these things fairly quickly once they're briefed, the Supreme Court makes decisions on them. So I would say we would expect to know whether the Supreme Court will take the case between 1 and 2 years.
I might.
Go ahead.
You've also taken action on the Glacier Bay case as well. Are you personally working on that one, Joanne? Or?
Through the chair, I am, yes.
And what's the co-relationship or the relationship between the two filing substances in that instance, between Katie John and Glacier Bay?
Through the chair, the issue in the Katie John case is whether public lands under ANILCA include waters that are subject to a Federal Reserve water right. At this point, the federal agencies are not claiming to have, we don't think they're claiming to have a reserve water right in marine waters because it's uniquely a freshwater issue or has been. The Glacier Bay case seeks to quiet title to the lands underlying the marine waters. So the Glacier Bay case really should have no impact on the Katie John decision or vice versa.
No impact. So the two separate issues.
Representative Dyson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any cases where reserve water rights have been assumed to extend beyond the reserved lands so that all the tributaries to a river that flow through a federal area
are, the feds think they have reserved water rights on those rivers, waters. I said that poorly, but I think you got what I meant.
Mr. Chair, I think I can answer that. I'm not aware of cases where they've extended the water right upstream or downstream from a particular area, particular federal area. However, with the reserve water right would come the right to enjoin other users, other presumably upstream users who are interfering with the water right as it flows through the federal area.
Thank you. That's all, Mr. Chairman.
I have a couple questions. One is, if we had resolved the subsistence issue in the special session and had taken action on that, we would not find ourselves in this position today. Is that right?
Through the chair, that is true. Because if we had resolved this issue through a special session, had a constitutional amendment, the subsistence priority would apply everywhere. And we wouldn't be concerned with the federal government usurping state authority to regulate navigable waters. The state would have authority to regulate everywhere, and the subsistence right would apply everywhere.
And under the court judgment that we find ourselves in now, what impact until, if you say it's maybe 1 to 2 years, or maybe even further than that, before this is finally resolved, what impact will this judgment have on our resources, and in particular the fisheries?
Through the chair, I would expect that it would have no impact. Because as the judgment stands, the Federal Subsistence Board has authority to regulate fisheries in these waters that the agencies have identified, and where the state is not going to seek a stay of that decision. So the status quo would maintain while we go through this process.
Could you explain to me on what basis did the administration decide to go forward with the appeal?
Through the chair, I can give you my understanding of it. I wasn't privy to the decision, but my understanding is that the governor believes that the subsistence priority should apply everywhere in the state. The problem with the definition of public lands for Title VIII of ANILCA is that there are two sides of that coin. On one side is the fact that public lands defines where the subsistence priority applies, and that is something that, as I understand, the governor wants to maximize, and he certainly said that consistently for a long period of time, and no one doubts his sincerity. The other side of that coin is public lands determines the area where the federal government can usurp the state authority to regulate fishing for subsistence purposes. And maximizing the public lands as it pertains to the right minimizes the area that the state has authority to regulate. And my understanding is that while the administration fully supports a subsistence right everywhere and believes that that is something that we must accomplish through a constitutional amendment, this appeal is really about the fact that the Katie John decision took away the state's authority to regulate its own resources. One of our main arguments in the Katie John case is that there's a court doctrine called the clear statement doctrine, and that says that courts will not infer a congressional intent to usurp a traditional state police power unless Congress makes that intent manifestly apparent. And the reason for that doctrine is that
to ensure that federal legislation isn't interpreted in such a way as to alter the federal state, the delicate federal state balance of power, unless Congress has thoroughly considered and fully intended that to be the result. And our argument in this case was, is, and has been that Congress didn't make clear in ANILCA an intent through its definition of public land to take away the state authority to regulate navigable waters in which there's a Federal Reserve water right. So I think the general principle here is, although the governor does fully support a subsistence right everywhere and continues to fight for that, he also believes that he has to defend the state authority to regulate its resources, where Congress really didn't make clear any intent to usurp that authority.
One final question that I have is that do you anticipate requesting additional funds to appeal this case at all?
I'm not really authorized to talk about that. That's a matter for the Department of Law. I don't really have a response to that.
Well, let me ask it another way then. How aggressive are you going to proceed with the appeal process?
We have discussed hiring outside counsel with a specialized knowledge in Supreme Court practice. It's really a specialized area, and although the Department of Law has many fine attorneys, we don't have enough Supreme Court cases so that any of us have developed that kind of expertise. So it is a matter that's under discussion.
Senator Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, just a matter of clarification. I think the testifier has said three times that the governor believes in subsistence right everywhere. In fact, he does not. He does not believe in a subsistence right for the people who live in my district. He believes in subsistence apartheid.
Senator Taylor.
Yeah, I was fascinated by your answer to Senator Lincoln's question about the constitutional amendment. And I think it was very carefully worded because what you said was absolutely correct, in my opinion, but it only told half the story. You answered her question when she said, if we'd have passed a constitutional amendment, would subsistence not now be in all our waters? And you said, well, yes, it would, and that we would then regulate them. The other half of the shoe that you didn't mention was that that regulation is required under the federal law. As we know, we've all written letters to the Secretary of the Interior how many different times on how many different modifications that federal law has to be mirrored within our state laws, and that the ultimate resolver of all disputes on subsistence after we've adopted it is going to be the federal courts, not the state courts. A federal judge sitting someplace, either in Anchorage or San Francisco or the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, will decide whether or not a commercial fishery opens or closes, whether or not sport fishing is allowed or closed. All personal use permits, according to the regulations you and I were talking about earlier, personal use permits that all of Alaskans are used to and understand, if you come from a community too large, those will not be allowed. If, in fact, they have to close any fisheries to protect subsistence. So it's a nice half answer, but it fails to mention what the ramifications are of us adopting the law. So I'd ask the question a little different way. Had we adopted the amendments, whichever one over the last 10 years you want to take, assuming one, I guess, in compliance with what the Secretary would accept, because he's the ultimate arbiter of every decision we make around here, whether it's good or bad. Assuming we had done that, what basis would you have at this point in time to even be appealing or staying, as you have, the Paradovich case? In fact, you would have given up that all of those legal arguments on the reserved water right question that you claim this governor wants to defend us on, You've given up all those things by adopting and conceding to the fact that the federal government does in fact have this reserve right, which I think most of us here at the table would dispute that they have such a right. Can you answer that?
To the chair.
If we had passed a constitutional amendment, then we would have state management of our fisheries, and we would have a subsistence priority for the people, for the rural residents of Alaska, that applies statewide. There would be no need to litigate reserved water rights or title to submerged lands in order to determine the scope of the right. The scope of the right would be statewide.
And to finish your sentence, statewide and dictated to us by the federal government on its interpretation of what its federal law means when applied in the field.
It is correct that the federal courts would be able to review state management on statewide.
And at any time that they found us not to be in compliance with their interpretation of the federal law, we would be out of compliance, and they would assert the very same jurisdiction they're claiming to assert today, and you as an attorney would have no legal basis to contest that, because we would have forfeited the reserve water rights question.
Through the chair, I think the reserve water rights question would just have no relevance. I'm not sure we would have forfeited in any legal sense.
So the right to manage our fish that we got and every other state got at statehood in our navigable waters, which has been assumed throughout in the Submerged Lands Act and in the statehood compacts and in the equal footing doctrine, all of that would go down the drain because we would have embraced a federal concept that the feds have this authority, and we would not now be contesting it and fighting to keep our fisheries under our control, would we? They'd be ultimately under federal control, statewide.
Through the chair. Well, the state would be managing them. I think the state management would be subject to judicial review in isolated cases, but I don't think it's fair to say that we would be giving up our right that we got to manage our waterways. We would have that right in a way that we don't have it when the Federal Subsistence Board is managing for us.
Why is it that we are not, in any of these cases, truly contesting the reserve water rights issue? Why is the administration dodging it by contesting instead the subsurface or the submerged lands? The fight over Glacier Bay hasn't got a thing to do with the mud on the bottom of Glacier Bay. It has a great deal to do with who's going to be allowed to fish in there, and are we going to let our fishermen be bought out by a federal bureaucracy? It doesn't have anything to do with mud or clams. It has a lot to do with the water column above it. But your brief limits your arguments totally to the submerged land itself. And when asked here today, you said, "Oh, you know, it's not going to have any effect on the reserve water rights question." Tell me why we're not arguing the reserve water rights question.
Through the chair, the federal authority that the Park Service is claiming to regulate fisheries in Glacier Bay National Park isn't based on a reserved water right. Title 8 actually doesn't apply in Glacier Bay National Park. Their authority is based on the fact that they claim title to the submerged land. They claim that those are essentially park lands over which the National Park Service has authority. So our claim is, no, they're not National Park Service lands, they're state lands. That's why we haven't raised a reserve water right issue. That's why we're limiting it to a title issue. That's the basis for their claim of authority.
So we could win Glacier Bay on your brief, and the federal government would still regulate Glacier Bay on the fisheries because they would say that no subsistence is allowed there. So the people of Huna are out to lunch, right? They still get thrown out because you're not arguing to save them or the crab fishermen. You're arguing only the limited technical aspects of who owns a submerged land.
Through the chair, the fact that there's no Title VIII subsistence right in Glacier Bay doesn't really have anything to do with the title to the land, or it's not really a state-federal issue. It's something that's in federal law, you know, precisely.
I'm very confused, Mr. Chairman. If it doesn't have anything to do with it, why in the world are we paying $300, or the federal government paying $300-some thousand to the fishermen so they won't crab fish there anymore?
To the chair, I guess I'm getting a little bit confused by your questions. I thought you were asking me why are we doing it if there isn't going to be a subsistence right if we win.
Well, that's part of it, but the other part is...
Oh, okay, I understand your question. You're saying if there's state waters, then... Okay, if we were to establish that those are state waters rather than Park Service lands, then the exception to Title VIII for Glacier Bay wouldn't apply to those waters.
Right.
And there would, sorry, I misunderstood. Right. There would be a subsistence right in those waters.
Not yet. They haven't extended it to marine waters.
It would, oh.
Okay. So the fishermen that we, the state of Alaska, sell a crab fishing license to, and it says you're allowed to fish crab in southeast Alaska, that license that we issue would still have some validity then in those waters if we fought and protected our right to issue that license in those waters. What you're telling us is you've got a case going to the United States Supreme Court that's going to talk about the mud, and it's not going to talk about who's going to regulate those fishermen in those waters.
Through the chair, as I said, the Park Service's assertion of authority is based on the fact that they consider those to be part.
I understand their claim. I'm right. Just trying to understand why we're not fighting on behalf of those fishermen and those users of that water. But one last question, I'll turn it back to the chair again. Why has the state failed to request a stay pending the outcome in Katy John? It's probably one of the single biggest decisions we have against us as a state on our statehood rights to regulate our waters. Why aren't you requesting a stay?
Through the chair, it's actually an issue that we haven't fully considered, and it's probably not too late to do it. I would consider it extremely unlikely that we would receive such a stay, but frankly, it's not something that we've thought about, so we will now.
They used exactly the same words, Ms. Chase, when we talked about the Venati case. We were all told that several thousand of these writs of certiorari go in every year, and you're only going to get 5 or 10 of them that are ever going to be heard, so your odds are very poor. But, you know, you don't get anything if you don't ask for it. And I think it's very telling that the administration has not authorized you to request a stay. I would hope they would, because that can impact every single subsistence user, as I call them, on a state basis, utilizing personal use permits, which are specifically not allowed under your federal subsistence law. So that's going to impact an awful lot of your constituents and other people that go to the Copper River or go to other dip net fisheries. It's going to impact people right here in this community, one of whom's on a hunger strike right now. He will not be allowed to have a personal use permit to go get sockeye if we embrace that and fail to get a stay. So I'm really kind of shocked that you're not doing it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Masick and then Senator May.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the point that Representative Taylor brought up, Joanne Grace, I have to agree with Senator Taylor, and you made it sound so simple that if we had a constitutional amendment, passed it, then the subsistence would be okay in Alaska. Constitution, you could give that away. But with the judicial court oversight that we have, ANILCA, and I have to say this over and over, because in ANILCA, unless there are ties and changes that go along with the constitutional amendment, we won't have true state management back. I had a question if this final judgment were overturned by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals or the U.S. Supreme Court. would the state retain its existing management authorities on navigable waters?
Through the chair, the Federal Subsistence Board is now, since October 1st, taken over fisheries management for subsistence purposes on navigable waters. So we wouldn't maintain our current status. We would regain our former status as being the regulator of fisheries in almost all waters in Alaska. Before the Katie John case, the Federal Subsistence Board had authority to regulate fisheries in non-navigable waters on public lands and in areas that were pre-stated withdrawal. It was fairly insignificant compared to the authority that they have now.
Senator Mackey?
Yeah, I was following Senator Taylor's line of questioning, and some of that I understood and some of it I didn't. When attorneys are talking, sometimes I get lost, but I just wanted to suggest, Senator Taylor, that you know, some of the questioning was going towards policy decisions, and I think both Ms. Grace and Ms. Swiderski handle the cases they're told to handle, and some of the policy decisions are not theirs to make. And I didn't want to make them feel too uncomfortable here, but I certainly have a better understanding now from the information they provided us to where we're going.
Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with Senator Mackey, but I also can't help but notice the absence of the Attorney General when it comes to discussing incredibly important cases that affect this case. And this isn't the first time, nor on this subject, do we find that the Attorney General comes up missing when it comes time to discuss these cases. So you do not make the policy calls, sometimes have to bear the brunt of a committee that wants to know why, and you can't answer it, so I apologize for that, but your boss should be here on some of these cases, but he takes a powder too often.
Further questions?
Well, thank you first of all for coming before the committee, and I personally just wanted to express that I'm encouraged by the fact that administration is certainly filing on the Glacier Bay case, and having had a very recent briefing on that whole situation and looking at the territorial waters and things of that nature, the wilderness waters, I'm sorry, not territorial, and the implications. I think if we win that one, we win something substantive, and we'll need to have a specific meeting on just that issue alone to try to figure out just what's there. And I'm also pleased, even though I may not, you know whether or not you, because I'm not an attorney, and I, you know, the good senator has really posed some serious questions, and I'm sure you'll take those back as well. But it seems to me like in this Katie John case that if we can make a clear understanding of what the federal government's responsibilities and authorities are and what the states are, we're going to be miles ahead of where we're at the present time. So I personally want you to proceed with all speed, with all resources, and I, for one, am going to support the necessary resources for the state of Alaska to pursue both those cases in a vigorous manner, and that's what I wanted to say.
Senator Taylor.
Yeah, thank you. And I, too, share the committee's appreciation for your candor today and both of you. I appreciate it very much. And I want to also mention the fact that I've had the opportunity to discuss many of these issues over the years with Ms. Chase, and been a good rapport, a very professional one, and I appreciate that also very much. I am only disappointed in the fact that we sit here today taking up cases that appear to me to be some of the narrowest, most constrained arguments and issues that we could possibly bring, and we're not yet addressing the overriding issue directly on a direct challenge, and that is the question of, as Representative Hudson just mentioned,
what is the federal government's authority in these waters, and what was conveyed to us at statehood? And apparently, from my reading of these cases, Sandra Day O'Connor is absolutely nuts, according to the interpretation currently being given by the United States government on her comments concerning the water column above submerged lands. She does not seem to recognize the distinction that you are laboring under and having to argue against. But the argument that you're offering has been constrained significantly by this administration in the way that they've approached it. And I think when I hear comments that we could win Glacier Bay and still have no resolution of the issue of reserve water rights, that's frightening, because that means that we basically have no case currently pending that hasn't been stayed where that issue is going to be determined. And maybe it's to the benefit, for political purposes, of some people around here to keep that issue from being determined. I believe that when it is determined, the state wins. And I have faith that the United States Supreme Court does know what it's talking about on water rights and on submerged lands and the statehood compact and so on. Now, others don't believe that. That may not be a true statement. They may also believe just as I do, but they know they're going to do everything they can to keep the Supreme Court from hearing that argument. And I find that very frustrating when I hear the comments that I've just heard. I realize you have no choice in these matters. I just find it very frustrating that you're not being allowed to defend this state as vigorously as I believe the Constitution calls upon the Attorney General's office to defend us. And it's because of that lack of defense that we've sat here for 10 years on this issue. So, I mean, I can tell Senator Kelly why we're not seeing the Attorney General here. The last time he was here, when we asked him in a joint judiciary committee of the House and the Senate why he had dismissed Babbitt, that threw the door wide open on us. Why did that happen, Mr. Attorney General? You remember what his answer was? Because it's on the record. We dismissed it for political purposes. The law hadn't changed. Politics had changed. That's why it was dismissed. That's why we're facing these problems today. And I would just encourage you in every way to do whatever you can to make certain that our state is protected, and that these matters go forward. And the only question I would have for you is, would the Attorney General's office welcome or appreciate the support of the legislature in its efforts through the form of an amicus brief on the same case that we've been currently discussing, both Katie John and the Glacier Basin?
Through the chair, that is a question for the Attorney General that I'm really in no position to answer at this point. But I would also like to say that I think that the decision to appeal this final judgment in Cajon is very much a decision to defend the state's authority to regulate its resources in navigable waters. And that has been the position of this governor since he got into office, and was the position of the former governor when the case started. So I don't see that he's wavered on his commitment to defending the state's authority to regulate since day one. In I think this appeal is a demonstration of that.
Again, thank you.
Further questions? If not, I appreciate the fact that you noticed the appeal. Are there going to be written arguments, or how does the process work? I mean, you file a notice of appeal. That's not much of a document. But do you then file a written series of briefs and then have the oral argument, or how does it work?
We will, Mr. Chair, we will file briefs before the Ninth Circuit. And we may or may not get oral argument. The way the Ninth Circuit operates on oral argument is that when they get a case, when a case is received and briefed, staff attorneys give it a ranking from 1 to 10. one being the least complex case and 10 being the most complex case. And I believe it's cases assigned a rank of 5 and above get oral argument, and those lower ranking cases do not get oral argument. We did get oral argument in our appeal in the Ninth Circuit earlier because it's clearly a complex case. I don't know whether it will be viewed in that light the second time around. It may just be viewed as something that's already been decided, not worthy of further argument. I can't say. So we may or may not have oral argument. And after a Ninth Circuit decision, a cert petition to the U.S. Supreme Court also involves briefing. So there would be a two series of briefings.
Oral brief. In terms of actual filing of briefs, when do you expect the first filing to occur?
I would expect that we would get a briefing schedule from the Ninth Circuit within 1 to 2 months, and generally they give parties 30 days to write a brief. So the state would have 30 days, and the respondents would have 30 days, and then there'd be maybe 15 days for a reply brief. Often parties get extensions in cases, so it's really hard to say that that will be the schedule. But several months.
Sounds like there's a reasonable chance we'll have the at least the initial briefs before this session is over.
There's a reasonable chance.
And they're, of course, public documents, are they not?
Of course.
We'll be interested to see them when they come out. Are there any further questions? Representative Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joanne, this case challenged the subsistence priority on federal lands.
The intention, through the chair, the intention is, I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Does this case challenge the subsistence priority on federal land?
The subsistence the subsistence priority applies to public land. That is the way the geographic scope of the right is determined. The right, a rural resident has a right to a priority in hunting and fishing on public lands, wherever public lands exist. This case does challenge the current definition of public lands, not because the administration would like to contract the area to which the right applies, but because the authority of the federal government to take over fisheries management also applies to public land. So in a sense, it does challenge the definition of public land, but not because the state wishes to challenge the subsistence priority in that area, but because the state wishes to challenge the authority of the Federal Subsistence Board to usurp the state's right to regulate those waters.
Let's say, for example, we look at the Yukon River, and with this Katie John case, if it was upheld and repealed or stayed in court, what will happen on the Yukon River? If the state lost the appeal and this final judgment went ahead.
Mr. Chair, for clarification, your question is if the state does not prevail on the Katie John appeal, then the status quo would remain in place and the Federal Subsistence Board would has asserted authority, the federal agencies have asserted authority over segments of the Yukon River that are within the boundaries of federal units, and they would continue to manage for subsistence purposes in those segments.
One more question, just to stimulate something here. Sometime back when we were looking at the subsistence resolution or the amendment proposed, at any rate, we were talking about the
Canadian River Treaty. That is a treaty with Canada, upriver, for example. She mentioned the Yukon, and it triggered my thought about on up the line. Does the court's determination on the Katie John case currently have to take into consideration or be subservient to the agreement between Canada and the United States, particularly on the river system? I understand that that treaty has a certain provisions in there for the supply of fish on up in the past there, and I thought maybe you might, that might be something you thought about or it might have a bearing on this case.
Mr. Chair, I think I can answer that. That my view is that the United States is a party to these treaties, which it is. The treaty, those obligations are overriding. So the United States' commitment to the treaties would stand, and the federal agencies would regulate within the context of meeting the treaty obligations.
So if Alaska were to secede from the Union and write a treaty with the United States, maybe we'd have control. Thank you. I'm being facetious.
That's a Hudson plan? Hudson plan.
Well, we got the Mackey plan. We may as well do it up strong.
Take some heat off of it, Bill.
If we don't have any further questions, we will be looking forward to seeing your initial briefs, hopefully before the end of the session, and winning the case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good luck and Godspeed. The next thing we have scheduled starts
I think we said 3:30, didn't we, when we were going to take that up?
Yes, if the folks are here, we'll start at any time.
We'll take a 15-minute break, and then we'll come back to order for the presentation from the Gas Pipeline Authority. Will the Joint Committee please come back to order? We now have a presentation on the Alaska Gas Line Port Authority. Whatever order you want to do it in, Chairman, it's up to you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chairman Hallford, Chairman Mathis, Chairman Hudson. My name is Hank Hogue. I'm mayor of the Fairbanks North Star Borough and chairman of the Alaska Gas Line Port Authority. And I'm on behalf of the Port Authority and Board of Directors and member communities, I want to express our appreciation for your taking the time for us to make this presentation to you here today. We're very appreciative of it. In October of 1999, the voters of the Fairbanks North Star Borough, the North Slope Borough, and the City of Valdez formed a port authority for the purpose of the construction and operation of a gas pipeline, which would finally, after over 20 years, commercialize that vast natural resource which we as residents of the state of Alaska possess on the North Slope. We have a nine-member board of directors. They are composed of three individuals from each community. And in the North Slope Borough, we have Mayor George Amoak, Richard Glenn, and Thomas Napagiak. And from the City of Valdez, Mayor Dave Cobb will be joining us here just momentarily when he completes another meeting. Dave Dangle and John Kelsey. And from Fairbanks, myself, former Attorney General Charlie Cole, and Barbara Schumann. We think, made considerable progress since October, and we have now formed a development team, which consists fundamentally of the Port Authority itself, and we have secured as EPC role player in the form of Bechtel, which is a world-renowned construction and engineering firm. We have with us a Yukon Pacific Corporation, which has worked for 18 years and has expended considerable sums of money to obtain the permits necessary to build an LNG facility and a pipeline. We have also secured the services of Peter DeYoung and of Merrill Lynch, and also general counsel from the Lower 48 with great expertise in areas of this nature, O'Melveny and Myers, and our general counsel from the state of Alaska is Walker, Walker, Wendland, and Osowski. And I would like to take this opportunity to introduce quite a number of people who have come to Juneau to join with us here from these various teams. From Bechtel, I'd like to introduce Barbara Treat, who is the Principal Vice President of the Bechtel Company, Walt Parsons, who is the Project Manager for Petroleum and Chemical of North America. Walt, if you stand, please. Brent Scherfe, who is Project Manager of Pipelines for Bechtel, and Yasser Dib, who is Vice President of Project Development and Finance for Bechtel. From the Williams Companies, which, as you may know, is probably the United States' largest pipeline operator, we have with us this afternoon Matt Gillis, who is the Vice President for Project Development, and Lou Posacani, who is the Senior Vice President for Group Planning and Development. We have, representing Merrill Lynch here this afternoon, Brian Andrews, who is a fellow Juneauite. And we also are pleased to announce the association of Jim Weeks with our group. And Jim is a longtime ARCO employee and formerly the field manager for ARCO at Prudhoe Bay, and brings with him considerable expertise in the area in which we're working. We are in discussions with the Williams companies with regard to a role that they might play in pipeline operations and with other partners yet to be identified and whose role is as yet determined, but we'll be very pleased to announce those developments to you at the proper time and when they transpire. The overview of the project is, of course, the treatment and transport of natural gas via pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez. This pipeline, as permitted by Yukon Pacific, fundamentally parallels the existing TAPS line. And at Valdez, we would convert the natural gas to liquid natural gas and ship it to the Far East markets, which are the markets planned for the sale of Alaska natural gas. At Prudhoe Bay, we would build a conditioning plant. That plant is for the purpose of removing water and carbon dioxide from the gas as it comes up out of the field, and then transporting it to tidewater in a pipeline with a diameter of up to 48 inches, and which would have future capacity for transporting up to 4 billion cubic feet of gas per day, should the markets demand it. At Valdez, we would construct the liquid natural gas plant that chills the gas to a liquid and prepares it for shipment. The chilling of the gas, essentially, I'm sure many of you already know this, essentially reduces the volume of the gas down to 1/16 of its former level when it was a vapor or a gas. The technical and environmental challenges to building a pipeline in Alaska are considerable, as we all know. As residents of this state, we know that it furnishes us with the challenges of some of the harshest cold weather environments in the United States, if not in the world, and that the pipeline of the sort that is proposed here by the Port Authority would be passing through areas of continuous and discontinuous permafrost. The pipeline would have pressures of greater than 2,000 pounds per square inch, and the gas would be chilled to a temperature lower than 32 degrees Fahrenheit, and the preservation of the sensitive habitats of wildlife and migratory herds and birds and streams and rivers containing native fisheries is extremely important, and was given particular attention in the permitting process as YPC went through that process in obtaining the permits. The challenge also before us is that of minimizing impact on the ongoing operation of the TAPS pipeline due to construction and operation of the new gas line. It would require considerable coordination between our contractors and Alyeska, who is the present operator of the TAPS. And we also need to arrange for the minimization of impact to existing crude oil bay operations due to construction and later through the operation of the new gas conditioning facility. So those are some of the challenges that face us in that area. In implementation challenges, we find that there have been a number of studies, and I'm sure members of this committee are very well aware of all of them, over the past 20 years to define a project, to design a project, and to market and fund a project. None of them have indicated under the typical private enterprise kind of approach to this particular problem, none of them have demonstrated that they had associated with any of the plans sufficient margins to be able to attract financing for one thing, or for being able to deliver gas to its market at a price that would find a buyer. The project viability and the schedule driven by energy supply and market conditions is a factor that challenges us. Our project viability is increased because of the nature of the public-private kind of enterprise that we are proposing, where we bring certain advantages in terms of financing and in terms of tax structure on net revenues that markedly change the economics of a gas pipeline, where it might formerly have been at the margins or less or lower. This project, financed and operated through a Port Authority kind of scheme, in fact, changes the economics of an Alaska gas pipeline in a very positive direction. And as the final bullet there on this page kind of says it all in terms of what I've already said, in terms of, in the past, the minimal financial benefits for a pure private sector solution just did not work out in terms of commercializing Alaska's gas and created a need for this kind of innovative public-private solution. So why is our project different? Well, there are substantial fiscal advantages using an Alaska Gas Line Port Authority method. There is the matter of not having exposed the net profits to federal income tax, which is the most dramatic example of the advantage offered by a Port Authority kind of approach to this problem. Also, to a lesser extent, in terms of importance, is the availability to some extent of tax-exempt financing for such a project, which would not typically be available to a strictly private sector kind of approach. Also, as Alaskans and as a Port Authority formed only for one purpose, we therefore have only one focus, and that focus is on the commercialization of Alaska's gas. We don't have projects in Gorgon or Qatar or Tangu. We have one project that is driving us, and we only will ever do one project, and that is an Alaska gas pipeline. Regulatory efficiency is also an advantage because of our association and their association with us, with what Yukon Pacific Corporation, which presently has many of the permits required to not only construct but to operate this pipeline. And the cost-effective technology of the conversion to LNG that we think is an efficient method of conversion that we plan. And the project economies that we think that we can bring to this project further enhance the possibilities and probabilities, in fact, we think, of achieving success, and the schedule and speed of development. Most other proposals that have to do with the commercialization of Alaska gas and the construction of a pipeline say that there's a market out there in 2010. That, we think, is also true. There is a market out there in 2010, but there's also a market window open in roughly the year 2005.
So our proposal envisions bringing Alaska's gas to market 5 years sooner than anyone else thinks that it is possible to do. And we think only we can actually meet that timetable. And presently, any other proposal would need to be permitted from the start, from the first permit to the last permit. That is a long and expensive process, would take a great deal of time, and if engaged in, would cause you to miss the 2005 time frame, which is the earliest that Alaska Gas can find the market. We're the only ones that can meet that timetable. The benefits to Alaskans are many. We will finally, for the first time, be able to provide for gas to many of Alaska's communities who presently do not enjoy access to this low-cost and lower-polluting fuel. Only Anchorage, Nemadsu, Burrough, and Kenai Peninsula presently in the state of Alaska enjoy access to this fuel. If this pipeline is constructed, Alaska's second largest borough, Fairbanks, would now have access to it. Valdez would, and all other corridor communities up and down the pipeline as well would have access to this efficient and lower cost fuel supply. And we would expect that these new energy supplies would also stimulate business development throughout the state, which would also have a very beneficial side effect on our economy at a time when we're wondering what we're really going to do about our economy. Also, it provides for, when sized properly, a potential spur line to the Cook Inlet to provide for an expanded gas supply for consumers there, and also possibly to provide for a fuel for gas-intensive industrial applications. And finally, and perhaps most importantly for us as Alaskans, the assurance of long-term gas availability. Also to the benefit of Alaskans, during the course of construction of the pipeline, it is the estimate of Bechtel that over 10,000 construction jobs would be created. This would not be quite reach the magnitude of the construction of TAPS, but nonetheless, it would be a very, very significant boost to the Alaska economy for the period of the construction of the line, and would have also direct contribution to the Alaska economy of $2 to $3 billion in local purchases of goods and services in support of the construction of the pipeline. After construction would be completed, permanent jobs in the form of 400 in-plant and pipeline operations jobs would be in the economy of Alaska over the long term for the life of the project, in fact, which would be several decades. And of course, then there's the indirect service and support employment that would result from the increased activity surrounding the operations of a pipeline. This would have a $100 million per year impact on the Alaskan economy. It would improve, by the way, not something that we're directly responsible for, but as a member of the United States of America citizenry, I think it's important for us to consider these smaller matters as well, would improve a very serious balance of payments problem to make up for all the Toyotas and Nissans and Hondas that we have bought over the years and no doubt will continue to purchase. And selling natural gas back to Japan would be an excellent way to at least partially eliminate that as a problem for the United States. And it would very significantly contribute to the state revenue, directly to the state of Alaska and to its citizens. Gas is the cleanest burning fuel that is commercially available. And we have in Fairbanks, as some of you may know, a very serious air quality problem. And there's an air quality problem in Anchorage as well, for that matter, and they presently consume gas. But we in Fairbanks and in other places in the state will benefit greatly in terms of the improvement in air quality as a result of burning this clean fuel as opposed to coal and as opposed to oil and to wood. And this pipeline would be an exemplary environmental project, adhering to the new regulations regarding air quality, and it would make it a model for future Alaska projects. And it would be designed for the utmost safety both during the construction phases and the operational phases. And there are even benefits to the gas producers who are presently engaged in the production of crude oil on the North Slope. First, there is no capital required of them to construct this gas line. And that is a matter of some advantage. They would then have capital available to do other projects of other sorts, perhaps, maybe not, elsewhere in the world. We'll provide the capital for the construction of this pipeline. It would also provide for significant revenues as a result of the purchase of gas from the producers on the North Slope. And over the long term would increase field life and oil recovery rate on the North Slope. What we are doing presently at this moment and in the near term is that we are making gas market initiatives, both including direct contacts with LNG off-takers in the Far East. We plan a trip to the Far East sometime probably in March, possibly and even in February, for the purpose of meeting with possible buyers in China, Taiwan, Korea, and Japan. Also, we will, at some time in the next few months, we'll receive the response to our ruling request from the IRS concerning the Port Authority's exemption from federal income tax. We are very confident about the outcome of this particular ruling, and we ask for it really only in order to provide a degree of comfort to the investors in the pipeline who, without it, might find it somewhat less attractive as an investment vehicle. And at that point, I'm going to turn this over to Brent Scherfe of Bechtel, if Brent would join me up here. Thank you, Brent, who will take us through some of the more technical aspects, which is where I get lost. So, Brent, take it away.
Thank you, Mayor Hogue, and thank you to the committee for the opportunity to speak with you today. Bechtel, along with the other associates on the development team, have been working diligently since the 1st of November in preparing the study and estimates of the project. And hopefully by about April, we'll have the results of those available to the report. Let me quickly go through some of the key components of those studies. First of all is the review of the existing regulatory and environmental permitting and approval processes that this project will entail. Certainly a number of studies have been done in the past, but this is probably one of the most highly visible projects in the first half of the 21st century from an environmental viewpoint, certainly for the state of Alaska, certainly for the oil and gas industry, and it will certainly set precedences in the future because of its size. As part of our study also, we are have about 45 to 50 individuals in our offices conducting the initial design basis for the gas plant on the North Slope, for the pipeline itself. This involves engineering studies for sizing of pipes, of hydraulic studies, flow rates, and of course with the LNG facility in the Valdez region, initial studies of the facilities there. Also as part of the study is the procurement of probably some of the largest orders of pipe and facilities, again, that will be going on over the next 10 years throughout the world. One of the largest procurement programs. That entails also delivery of 800 miles of pipe, delivery of the facilities on the North Slope, and construction of those. The logistics program is enormous, and the timing and scheduling of making sure that everything arrives correctly on time in the right locations is a very large study in itself. As part of that study, we are also concentrating on maximizing the Alaskan content of the procurement activities, identifying sources of materials, equipment, suppliers here in Alaska to make sure that this is an Alaskan project first. There are certainly other components that are perhaps not available in Alaska, and we're certainly identifying those. Pipe, for example, we have made contacts both within the 48, lower 48, along with Japan and also in Europe. The construction plan and schedule is a process of sequencing the construction process. And putting it into a schedule where we still target the 2005 completion. Issues such as work during the winter months, windows on the north slope for being able to ship materials and modules into Prudhoe Bay, rail shipments and shipments that would not be in conflict with the existing rail shipments up to Fairbanks, all of these issues that go into a construction plan. Example is construction camps along the pipeline, locating them, pre-building them in adequate enough time in order to accommodate the various crews and individuals to be constructing the pipeline, as well as facilities on the North Slope and also in Valdez. Also on that last slide, one of the other key components as part of the environmental permitting process is the environmental monitoring and inspection process during construction and during operations. The assurance that all of the construction activities adhere to the regulatory requirements imposed by the agencies and good sound business practices that they're adhered to. This will be a major portion of our construction activities. The ongoing environmental monitoring during operation deals with making sure that the operation of the pipeline and facilities, again, adhere and meet the environmental requirements that will be part of the permitting process and the permit conditions for the project. Also, you know, further on in the interest of maximizing Alaskan content, is a study of the Alaskan labor market and assuring that we have skilled Alaskans available and for the both construction and operation of the project, identifying locations of those skills and enhancing those that perhaps through training programs in order to improve, again, Alaskan employment on the project. Operating and maintenance plan, this is an overall program for, initial program for identifying the operational components and maintenance components of the facilities. The estimated capital costs and operating and maintenance expenses is a result of these studies. Once we can quantify and place dollar amounts on each one of the components of the engineering process, the procurement process, the construction process, and the O&M process. So we have input into our overall financial and economic analysis. The economic analysis is being conducted as we speak with input from Taylor DeYoung, and also our other associates on the development team. And will give us a, we are running various scenarios identifying the optimum combination of sizing, of scheduling, of pricing of various components of the project. Commercial structuring is more from a contractual commercial development and again taking a look at various forms of commercial structure for the overall project. The preliminary financial plan is again taking a look at optimizing the, given the various sources of financing that are available to us and developing that from, a very initial stage. And also taking a look at the various risks associated with this project. It's not risk-free. That's one reason why it hasn't been built yet. And the components from the economic risks, the technical risks, the financial risks, the environmental risks, and certainly the social risks that are associated with the project. So that, in a very quickly in a nutshell, gives us an overview of the work that we're doing within the development team. We're about halfway through that process.
And that concludes our presentation, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman.
Questions?
I'm willing for questions.
Senator Kelly.
Mayor Hove, I've had some discussions with people in the Capitol here about this project, and people who don't live in the corridor ask the question, what's in it for me? Could you briefly go through what is in it for the rest of the state, not only on a community basis? For instance, you had mentioned the gas spur that might go off to Cook Inlet, but royalties, how those might be distributed.
Through the chairs and Senator Kelly. Early on, because we recognize the fact that while the gas may be under lease presently to the producers of that operating on North Slope, that any activity in which we may be involved that would produce revenue, net revenue, should probably be shared with the state of Alaska, because all Alaskans have an interest in the slope and what's there, including this gas. In addition to that, and we propose sharing more than half with our original thinking with the state of Alaska directly to its general fund for appropriation by the legislature for whatever purpose it may deem appropriate. We also had an addition to that in mind of the application of about half that amount for distribution directly to every resident of the state of Alaska. And further, a further distribution of a small fraction, perhaps 10%, directly to the residents in the communities that formed the Port Authority originally in October of 1999. So, putting aside sufficient reserves, which are necessary to ensure ongoing and efficient operations, after that has been done and all costs have been met and paid, then the net amounts left over will be distributed directly back to the state of Alaska and its residents in one form or another.